Welcome to Changing Academic Life. I'm Geraldine Fitzpatrick, and this is a podcast series where academics and others share their stories, provide ideas, and provoke discussions about what we can do individually and collectively to change academic life for the better.
Research culture is such a hot topic at the moment, as is the topic of change, with so many of our institutions going through restructuring and downsizing and reorganization. And I think you might agree with me that our academic and research sector is traditionally not very good at either of these. So this is a wonderful conversation here with Jane Price that shows some very different ways for how we can make work work better for people. Jane is in one of those research-adjacent roles that we heard about in the last episode. She's Transformation Director and Head of Continuous Improvement with the STFC. STFC is the Science and Technology Facilities Council, which is one of nine councils in the UK Research and Innovation portfolio. Their website talks about STFC supporting research in astronomy, physics, space science, and operating world-class research facilities in the UK. Jane's description about herself from LinkedIn captures a lot of what you will hear in this episode. She talks about leading transformation is about a human-centered, purpose-led change that cuts through bureaucracy and unlocks collective intelligence. And she talks about how she works with leadership teams to clarify direction, simplify complexity, and build cultures grounded in trust, accountability, and psychological safety. It's also challenging outdated hierarchies, enabling empowered teams, and replacing control with clarity. So if you are in any sort of leadership role, this is an episode that you will want to listen to again and again. And even if you don't have a formal institutional leadership role, she says towards the end of the episode that we all have the power to step into leadership behaviours wherever we are and to make a difference. We start talking about Jane's background and work more generally, and then we get into some very specific examples of how this plays out. I loved how she talks about leadership that's focused on the we rather than the I, and what does good look like, and also exploring different ways of working. In the course of the discussion, she also points to loads of different resources. So I've collated these on the episode webpage, so make sure you look there to follow up on them. There's so much there that points to very practical ways that we can make our research cultures so much more supportive, collaborative, how we can do leadership differently. So enjoy this episode. Jane, welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to see where our conversation goes, because on your LinkedIn banner, you've got, "There must be a better way." And that's what I want to talk to you about. What's that better way for work? Do you want to introduce yourself a little bit by way of background?
Yeah, firstly, thank you so much for reaching out. This is my very first podcast. So apologies to the listeners if it comes across as clunky. My name is Jane Price. I am based in the UK. I work for the most outstanding organisation, which is called UK Research and Innovation. And we're entrusted with £10 billion of taxpayers' money. And we invest that in our organisation. And our mission is to advance knowledge, improve lives, and drive the growth of the UK economy. And I walked into this organisation in 2003, having come from the private sector. And as soon as I saw the work that we were catalysing to solve real global challenges that face the world today, it absolutely stole my heart. My background is in change. Mm. I started off as a project manager.
You did do a computer science degree, didn't you?
Yeah. So I started in IT back when there were mainframes and we did learn about punch cards. So showing a bit about my age there. But yes, my background is software engineering and I moved into project management when I was considering starting a family. And I recognised that I was in a database administrator role at the time, which was 24/7, keeping our servers for the joint electronic submission platform up for people to apply for grants for research. Mm. And I thought being on call would not be good if I was feeding children in the middle of the night. So I moved into project management and found that I had this beautiful ability to translate requirements from users into the right language for the coders to understand what was required. And it just allowed me to sit beautifully between, sit in that translation role. And I've always had a real passion for working with people. And I really loved the variation that working on different projects gave me. So even though I'll have been in the organisation for 23 years in January, I feel as if I've had so many careers within the one organisation. So as I became skilled as a project manager, I moved into programme management.
What's the difference between project management and programme management?
Oh, great question. Projects are sort of quite small packages of change. It's normally just one sort of change that you're responsible for. But as you move into programs of change, it's too big to be managed as an individual project. So you tend to have an overarching vision for the change and a blueprint of what the change will look like. And then you have many projects that make up the shifts that you need to deliver that big vision. So it's normally sort of a larger change that you're trying to navigate and bring about across the organisation. And then from there, I moved into continuous improvement. I sort of understood, you know, how processes worked across the organisation and how we could improve processes. And then I moved into transformation. Let me start there. So I moved into a transformation role.
Can I ask transformation versus change? Because is transformation just sort of like the trendy name for change, or is it something different?
Transformation, in my opinion, it now moves into changing an entire organization. So it normally encompasses, you know, organization structure change, and it spans the official term of organization development, which is predominantly a HR practice, but I found that I had a real passion for it, which I stumbled into it through my change journey and recognized that in order to make really significant changes across an organization, you needed to look systemically across every part of it. And when I studied organization development, I was handed this picture of what organization development covered. And it's the entire organization. You know, it's how leaders lead. It's the language we use. It's the behaviors we have. It's how we're structured. It's what's the purpose of the organization. What are the clear roles and accountabilities to deliver the vision of the organization? It's the processes, it's the systems, it's this entire system-wide view on how this very complex organization works. And what I recognized as I embarked on the journey is that the approaches that I'd been using to stimulate change, I stumbled upon the Kinevin framework introduced by Dave Snowden. As I got deeper into transformation. And I recognized that in managing projects, I'd been working in the complicated framework or in his very simple model, a simple change, a complicated change, a complex change, and then this uncharted chaos kind of area. And in order to develop change from a project perspective, you could work really easily in the complicated area. So you could have a plan that started at X and ended in Y, and you could clearly articulate the steps that you needed to do to actually implement that change. But when you started getting into the realms of transformation, you moved into the complex quadrant of his work. And what I understood is the only way to really stimulate change working across an entire organization was to move into experimental and agile ways of working. So you don't have the confidence to understand if the change that you're going to do will actually make a difference. So my whole emphasis changed to that of running trials, running experiments, piloting changes in certain areas to actually measure the impact of the change that looked good on paper, but it wasn't until you put it into the system that you actually realized that it was positive or negative or neutral. So I guess to go back to your question of what is transformation and what's the difference, it's complex, it's no longer complicated, it's systemic, and it's this beautiful puzzle to be solved of all of these different jigsaw pieces that need to align to shift the culture and direction and ways of working of an organization to achieve its outcomes and goals.
I can imagine that the experiments that you talked about also help uncover what all of those connections are and what the adjacent pieces are, because you often don't know until you get in and try things.
Oh, absolutely. So we've got a number of experiments underway. And the important point in it all, really, I mean, I'm surrounded by engineers and compute people, and they, in the insights theme, they're very blue. So in order to convince people to change, because change is really hard, you have to have hard metrics to actually demonstrate that it's worth the effort of them changing. And as we run different experiments, what I've become absolutely, I guess, dogged about is the importance that you take a baseline of how an area is performing before you undertake any change. And then you design opportunities to actually remeasure at staged intervals to actually see if the change that you've put into the system has actually made a difference. And, you know, as a word of warning to everyone out there, it gets worse before it gets better. So you have to be willing to hold people's hands as they adopt new ways, as they adapt, sorry, to new ways of working. Because, yeah, change is really difficult, particularly in our environment where we've seen very little change for many, many years. So it's to expect it to get worse before people then start believing, getting confident, working in another way, before you then start to see the uptake and the uptick in performance.
I think that was part of my motivation for wanting to talk to you as well, that point that you just made about very little change over a number of years. And it feels like the academic and research sector areas are quite bureaucratic, quite set in their ways, quite difficult to change, quite subject to all sorts of horizontal and vertical pressures as well, because there are the bigger structural issues that might be happening at a national level. I mean, you even talked about UKRI and that huge pot of monies that they're funding. And then you're currently working in a space research Institute, and and then there's that whole disciplinary area that they would speak to, as well as the intersections with industry. Are there any particular ways that you would characterize this sector and the challenges around change, say, in comparison to other sectors that you're familiar with?
Oh, another great question. So if I start off with the sector at large, so we're part of government, UK government, and we are bound by very tight policies to ensure that we are spending taxpayers' money in the right way, that it's not, subject to fraud. So there's two sides to UKRI. We have the funding arm, where we receive money, and that funding sponsors research in different areas not conducted by us. And we absolutely need, the tight controls, the auditability that we are funding the right things. We have very robust peer review processes, and that rigor is really needed. However, where we confuse matters is we have another side of our business, which is actually delivering innovation through these massive large campuses that we have. And it's almost as if you need to flip the model in that case, because what you want to unlock on the delivery arm is this innovation. And you need to, in order to innovate, you need to have a culture where there isn't fear. You need to give people autonomy to explore and experiment and, to try things and it be safe to fail. You need to have very diverse teams. You need to have an environment that encourages that innovation. And that's something that we're really looking at as we start to transform STFC in more general terms, is whether there's an opportunity to govern two sides of that maybe slightly differently. But going back to your question in terms of, you're part of a bigger institution, I agree. But there are loads of opportunities to actually explore new ways of working, even within the constraints of a wider body. And my belief has always been that we need to focus on making ourselves really efficient and effective first before we start throwing stones at the big policies that constrain us, because there is loads of waste in the system already that we can be doing to improve ourselves before we then criticizing other areas. So yes, I think we need to be able to hold the mirror up to ourselves first and improve how we work before we then start saying, you are now properly constraining us because we've done everything we can inside the tent to improve how we work. And then it's about measuring and giving ministers facts on, how long these procurement rules take to procure parts that really slow us down. But I think there's lots we can do internally first before we start pointing fingers.
And by ourselves, you didn't mean ourselves as Jane, the individual, but you meant the organization internally that you're working in. And just a clarification as well, STFC is.
Oh, great. So UKRI is made up of nine constituent parts. So we were seven research councils originally, everything from Arts and Humanities Research Council right through to the Medical Research Council. STFC is one of the councils. It stands for the Science Technology Facilities Council. We are the largest council of the seven. The other two partners are Innovate UK, that are driving this innovation and UK economic growth, or a key part of that. And the other one is Research England, who work really closely with university and injecting them with money to do what they need to do.
I found it really interesting that you talked about the funding arm and the innovation arm and almost needing to flip the scripts that, and then you talked about that there's still so much that we can do internally to bring about change. Can you give us some practical examples from what you're trying now, experiments or some of the initiatives, like some of the things that maybe were the bigger stumbling blocks or problematic areas?
Yes, absolutely. So within the space department, well, the absolute first step is having a leader of a department that believes that there is a better way. So we have many people leading the departments that have worked here for years, have never seen how the world of work has moved on. And that's no criticism to themselves. They've just never focused on how we work. They are renowned scientists. The changes that they've brought about to the world are amazing, and I'm in awe of them. But as an organization, we've paid little attention to how we work, and we've almost rested on our laurels on what we've delivered. But I guess I'm curious to understand that if we do improve how we work, how many more opportunities we get to deliver more for the taxpayers' money. So step one is getting somebody, the gatekeeper, the director, to recognize that there is lots that we can do to improve how we work.
And how do you do that? Because you are talking about people who, this is the way we've always done things, and they're often so focused on the science, and they have ways of working now that do produce the science, as you say, and we're not trained to be reflective in any way about our own practices. So how do you even start those conversations with senior scientists, researchers, leaders?
So I was really fortunate. Dr. Sarah Beadsley, who's now the director of the Space Department, she was on secondment before she became the director as an associate director working with the National Laboratory executive team. And we, through COVID, we started having conversations about the work that I was leading, about my passions. And we started almost a book club. And we started reading the work of the Corporate Rebels. We started reading the work of Aaron Dignan, Brave New Work. We started understanding the work of Daniel Pink, of what motivates people. We sort of went on this journey together of understanding how the world of work has moved on. And yeah, she became absolutely fascinated. And when she became the director, she expressed an interest to actually start implementing the kind of change that she'd read about and the importance of culture, the importance of leadership, and how impactful that was on the performance of the department. And not only the performance of the department, the performance happens when you give people the best environments to do their best work. And she has become a huge advocate for that. And she invited me in to take on a secondment within the department to help her transform the department. And we started off, she made some structural changes. She had a very large management board in the early days. And her first move was to make a very, very small team that could make decisions that would meet weekly, make decisions really quickly, and focus on the really important high-level decisions that she, as them as a small executive team for the department, needed to make. And she brought in this powerhouse, this trio that is just brilliant. She recognized that they needed to have a tighter control on the work that was coming into the department. So she set up a portfolio management approach and hired a head of portfolio. She then had the head of operations on the top table alongside the head of portfolio and also the head of researchers. And you then had this beautiful trio with the head of researchers working with all of the scientific brilliance to say, where do we want to take the department? What's the strategic direction? And what are the roadmaps in our areas of science and research do we think will deliver that vision. Then the head of operations, when he knew the direction of travel, he could then look at the workforce and say, have we got what we need to deliver the roadmaps of the future? So we were, for the first time ever, able to take a strategic workforce planning approach. And then this beautiful role, which was new to the department, which is head of portfolio, then said, well, great, that's all well and good, but we also need to return a profit to be able to fund future research. So her challenge was we needed a mix of the work that we conducted, because some of the stuff that we do at the early grant stage, it's not the full economic cost.
Yeah.
But without that curiosity-driven element, we don't have the future thinking that will drive our big commercial contracts of the future. So it's then this really difficult challenge which she brought to ensure that we had the right funding mix of opportunities that would set us up in a way that would allow us to return enough money to fund a lot of this research that was unfunded. So, yes, she brought together this really tight team. For the first time ever, she brought communications to the top table, recognizing that any science delivered, if it's not communicated, is undone, unknown. So really recognized the importance of the storytelling around the work that they were doing. And she's also got HR and finance and the business development staff there. But this trio was really novel and really exciting. And then each of the three of them have boards underneath where they bring together the researchers and the project managers and the program managers under the portfolio management to make sure that they were all supporting projects if they started to struggle. So they were proactively supporting where they needed to and redirecting resource in the right way. And then operations was making sure that we had, you know, that people were thriving, they were safe with the health and safety aspects, all of the mandatory training that we need to do. And the other thing she was really adamant about was driving an excellence in people management. So in the way that we've worked over the years in a very academic environment, as you go up the chain, the way in which you go on to the next level is you need to take on people management. And you and I probably know that sometimes these technical, brilliant people are not that great in managing. In fact, they see it as a distraction from doing their world-leading science. But it's the only way that they could get promoted in the past. So what she's done is she's decoupled the technical promotion routes from the people management routes. And she is driving the people that do choose the people management routes to become excellent in people management. Because the old adage is you don't leave a job you hate, you leave a bad manager.
Manager, yes, indeed. Indeed. And again, it's one of the things that we're never taught about, well, to be reflective practitioners for ourselves, but we're never taught also the skills about how to work with people and how to bring out the best in people.
Oh, I was given a PDF. I took online management. I was given a PDF to read, and that was it.
And I'm sure that was helpful. So that's very exciting. I mean, that's creating different career paths for people. I love that decoupling. And it enables people to move into those areas, roles where they'll really shine. If they're really excited about doing technical work and think people work is a distraction, let them do technical work and be really brilliant at it. Did that create any tensions, though, in again, in communicating that or implementing that change? Because, again, like it's such a standard model of promotion.
Yes, it did. It's really interesting because people see it as a perceived loss of power. So in moving away from managing swathes of people, even though it's You know, it's something that they've always asked for, they've always wanted. It seemed almost as a demotion, even if you're not removing any pay and rewards for that individual, to not be the group leader or the division head of these big groups of people.
Is it the labels that were attached to the roles that people were playing that were signifiers of status?
And, you know, I guess convening groups of people, standing up in front of them, sharing information, being the central focus of the people. And that was something that we didn't really expect. You know, you thought it was something that people would have loved, the opportunity to focus on their research. But it did have that, that side impact of almost like a loss of identity. Of, you know, what does this mean? I'm not seen as the focal of this division anymore. And it's that reset of kind of who they are. So, yes, and you know, the importance of then fully supporting these people managers to move into adult-to-adult relationships with teams, of setting very clear expectations, leaning into challenging conversations, giving feedback well to staff, managing performance, which HR has used to, in the olden days, support line managers in having very difficult conversations. And like most organizations, we've moved to become more of a strategic HR, and they're not at the end of corridor anymore to be able to handhold people in these conversations. So it's now about equipping these people managers to sit in those really challenging conversations and to hold the line, particularly as you've got, you know, a lot of neurodiverse people coming into the workplace who have always been there before, but now they're more aware of the labels. And it's ensuring that you hold the line to say, you are paid to do a job. We are expecting outputs from you, and we are prepared to make reasonable adjustments, but there is an expectation that you will deliver. And I think it's become really difficult for people to have those conversations where they have that constant fear of being taken to a tribunal for not upholding the rights of, you know, very various protected characteristics.
And how are you navigating these challenges then? Is it through training, communication, the experimental approach?
It's experimenting with training. So it's trying different training approaches with different groups of people to see what's the most effective. There is a leading organization that I've been exposed to through the Corporate Rebels, which is called Tough Leadership, led by a remarkable woman called Karen Torelius. I'm not sure how you say, an amazing Swedish woman, and Lisa Gill, who supports Karen and lots of other brilliant trainers. And they deliver a training course that's incredibly impactful, which is allowing people to hold up a mirror to their blind spots and giving feedback to people live on the course. And it's really interesting. The people that turn up and say, I don't think I need this training, are normally the ones that need it most. You know, that say, I've done coaching, I'm a skilled coach. And yeah, it's really fascinating. But we need to equip people with the skills to have these adult-to-adult conversations.
That sounds like quite a confronting course in a way.
It
It
is.
sounds like it's very personal. You can't escape it. You can't escape that mirror.
But I think that's, well, I guess, as I've moved up in the organization, is it just about moving up? It might just be an age thing. But when you move into leadership roles, you recognize that so much of your impact is based on your self-awareness. And I think what I observe in, I don't know if our environment is the only one, but there's quite little reflective practice that happens at the leadership levels. And we are lacking role models. People have come through the academic environment where the focus, and I'm seeing this firsthand with my daughter as she does her A levels, it's very much about I. So I need to do my best. I am better than that person over there. I need 3A stars to go to Oxford or Cambridge. It's very much about the ego and self. And our entire organization is built on the brilliance individual minds. So they have worked with their communities. They've developed the research. You know, many of these people have been working on their research for decades, and they're the likely future candidates for Nobel Prizes. But it's very much about, I am the first author. I need to be seen. I need to be the top of my community in order to attract funding for the research and the technological builds that we need to do, or the science, the facilities time I need to undertake my research. And when you move into a leadership position, it needs to be more about how can I serve? How can I unlock the potential of others? Or shift into we rather than I. And I think that's incredibly hard for people. I think it's really hard. And I say this with absolutely no criticism, because the work they're conducting is going to change the world. But I don't think we've ever invested the time in allowing them to see what good looks like, or how they could be even more impactful.
Even more. Yeah. It's that the we is so important, and our metrics for measuring success within the research space reinforces that I and makes invisible the whole complex of people and teams that go into it.
Because what you see happening is people feel completely undervalued in the teams because they're never the first author. They're sometimes not even referenced in papers. And they don't feel that they matter. And you ignore and you undermine people at your peril, because they'll leave, or they will quietly quit, which is
I was
even
just going to say
worse.
they don't leave, but they're not there. Their bodies are present, and they do the basics. So again, in the new mindset that you have and your new different thinking about change and transformation, how are you addressing these? I can just hear our university faculties, departments, project teams, our research groups all dealing with the same challenges of the I focus, but it's the we that actually gets the work done, and leaders needing to do that shift. So you talked about training, and you also talked before about the best environments, the people perform best in. So I imagine they all go together as well.
They do. So the first step is you have to have an open mind. There are certain directors in this organization that I will never, ever reach. Very fixed mindsets. Don't believe that they've got any growth left to do. And there's no moving. There's no moving them. But for the directors that do have an open mindset, or the leaders that do, and I absolutely see the next generation coming that are thinking very differently, it's about they've got to do the work. They've got to see what's needed and what it will do to unlock the potential of others. And I've seen it in action, and it's incredible. And they've got to do the work. They have to hold up the mirror. They have to really focus on the areas of growth that they need to grow. They need to read the material. They need to understand what good looks like and be the role models. that the organization needs. You can't do that for them. You can only show them the direction, show them the way, be the change, which I absolutely live and breathe every day. But without the willingness to want to change, there's nothing you can do.
Yeah. And you're also pointing to it being an ongoing learning journey. Can you give some very specific examples of what does good look like?
Oh, brilliant. I think it's humility, it's vulnerability, it's explaining. I think it's really uncomfortable for people to say they haven't got all the answers because they've built their entire career on having all the answers. And I think there's a beautifulness in vulnerability of saying, you know, guys, we have a problem. I need your help in fixing it. What can we do? How can you help me? Or we need to solve this problem. How can we work together as a team? I don't have all the answers. How can you help me? And it's about vulnerability. It's about the values, the authenticity, the kindness. And I don't conflate that with niceness. It's not about being nice. It's about holding the line with compassion and empathy. It's about being human. It's about recognizing that you have struggles too and sharing that with people so that they can be human in the teams. It's dropping the corporate mask. I'm quite open about the menopausal struggles I've had in order to make it okay for the next generation of women coming, that when it hits them, they know that it's normal and the organization will support them through that really, really difficult time of their lives. So it's about being human, and it's role modeling another way. And you've got to be incredibly confident in who you are to drop the corporate mask. And I've done the last sort of 2 or 3 years and an awful lot of work on myself of understanding my blind spots, my shadows. I elicit feedback from people so that I can understand those blind spots and work on them and adapt in who I am as I work with different audiences and different people, but never swaying away from my values and my beliefs and being holding that conviction in how I think things could be better and how we could change, even through the eye rolling, the tutting, she doesn't even know what she's talking about. She's not an engineer. Who is she to tell us what to do? You know, it's really challenging. But I think if you're grounded and you have that much conviction in another way, that I cannot let it go.
Yeah. And you used we a lot there, and that goes to it as well, doesn't it? Because you're not the engineer, they are, and that's what they bring, and you bring other things. It's the we and the and that is entailed in the we that's together.
Yeah.
Would you be prepared to talk any more about the shadow sides that you've been sort of dealing with, or the blind spots?
Oh, yes. So I work in a, as I said, a very blue environment, and I am sunshine yellow. And the feedback.
So what do you mean by blue?
So blue on the insights is very detailed, very pragmatic. Show me the evidence.
Yeah.
I'm not going to change unless I've got a really clear plan. I need, you know, engineers need a plan. They need to ensure that what they build or what they design can be built.
Yes.
So they're always working from a position of certainty.
Mm.
And the transformation approaches that we need is one of complete ambiguity.
Yeah.
So the first shift has been to try and get people to think, you know, even though as scientists, you're very accustomed to experimenting, they're very reluctant to experiment in ways of working. They want that certainty that whatever you put into the system, it's going to work first time. And that's been quite a big barrier. But in terms of the shadow side, so I present as a very sunshine yellow person, which is a glass half full, loads of energy, loads of enthusiasm. And that can be off-putting to people whose energy levels are very different. So I've learned to really take a measured approach in how I deliver messaging. We're working with very reflective people. So I've learned that it's always really wise to give them stuff to read in advance, to digest, so that when we do go into the conversation, they've had a chance to really reflect, do their own research before they will offer any sort of buy-in or engagement in an idea. So that really pays dividends. Yes, I think for me, the big blind spot is around energy levels, the choice of language that I use. I also, in my, I guess, another flaw in my character that I had was I was almost a chameleon. So I have an ability to read and feel the room. So as I was delivering key messages, I was picking up that they weren't landing with people, and I was almost diluting my message, picking up on how the messages were landing. And what I've recognized is it's incredibly ineffectual because your supporters then think, oh, she's not as committed as she said she was because she's now dialing down her message. And so where I flipped my way of being and working was very much to work with the willing, to invest the energy in the people that really got it, in the hope that as we started to transform these departments to be more effective and efficient and places that people love to work within, that that would be the case study that would encourage the sort of people in the middle that were undecided to have a go at changing themselves. Rather than working on the really loud dissenters that were incredibly vocal, taking all of my energy to influence.
And taking it, literally taking it, so that you didn't have the energy to stand on the message so strongly.
So it was, fascinating.
That sounds like a really effective strategy if you've got willings there to work with. Do you think you're getting some case studies that are coming through and are starting to make people sit up and go, oh, maybe there is something to this?
It's really interesting. So if you spoke to the people at the coalface and, you know, their line management, absolutely, yes, they're starting to see the benefits of the changes in the ways of working, in the change in leadership, in what we're doing to improve processes and ways of working. I'll talk through another experiment in a moment around holacracy that we're trialing. So the people on the ground floor are absolutely seeing the benefits, but the people that we've upset at the top that have now been removed from, you know, the senior boards, have been maybe relinquished of their people management, they're not so bought in or thinking that it's the right thing to do because they're the ones that have been personally affected in the changes and that perceived loss of power. So it's really fascinating, but the truth will be in the performance of the department, and they're starting to see some shifts in the productivity rates, projects finishing on time and to cost. They're starting to see some shifts in the dial of the metrics that really matter. We also run an annual people management survey every year, and we're expecting the results from that soon. So that'll be really interesting to see if the engagement scores have gone up. But we
Is
also
your
run
sense that they will from the feel that you have?
Definitely. Absolutely. But surveys are flawed themselves because the people that generally fill them in are the ones that either feel really bad about the changes or the opposite, really positive. But the discussions I've had and how engaged people are in the various experiments that are running. And I think another metric for me is the space department embraced continuous improvement. And they created a role for a continuous improvement lead 3 years ago. It's actually 4 years ago. And they cycle the membership of that role. And we've just recently done a refresh of the continuous improvement lead role. And this is leading these experiments, looking at the changes that the department needs from a system-wide perspective. And the talent, you know, the number of applications we had, the talent of the individuals that applied for that role is, I think, a signal that there's now belief in the value of this work and, yeah, how important it is and how fulfilled people get in bringing about really meaningful change for their colleagues.
Yeah. And like everything that you've said, it's not about change for change's sake. It's there must be a better way. It's making work work better, as you say.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then we do better work and have more fun.
Exactly. And it's creating environments where people can come in to do their best work. And in many cases, it's the best work of their lives.
Yeah.
Because they're building these, you know, these technologies to launch into space or ground-based or with lasers that, you know, they're pushing the boundaries of physics in the instruments that they create. You know, we're leading the world with the technologies that we're developing. People have that intrinsic motivation to be there, but they get frustrated by the sort of surroundings of not having the part in the right place where you expect to find it because somebody's moved it, not having a world-class environment to work in, not having really seamless processes that they can follow rather than carrying out a number of steps that nobody looks at or adds any value at all. So it's kind of looking at the whole value stream of the work that they do and making sure that you're improving every part of it.
And you, like you mentioned a lot of those before at the beginning around leaders and language and behavior and structure and purpose and roles and processes and accountability.
It's all connected.
It's all connected.
It's all connected. And, you know, it'll take years. I don't think it's ever done. It's never done, but it needs to have focus and it needs attention if we are to create these beautiful workplaces for people to flourish within. And I think the generation coming into the workplace now are expecting something very different.
Yeah.
And we need to challenge them. We need to empower them with mentorship and coaching to give us what they've got. Rather than putting them in a box and letting them play small, let's just unleash it.
Or make them frustrated by following, as you said, a whole lot of meaningless steps that no one cares about just to tick the box.
Exactly.
You said you're going to talk about the holacracy experiment.
Yeah. So it's a really fancy term for something that was brought about by Brian Robertson, an entrepreneur working in an organization, I think a software company in the US. And he recognized as he was scaling his business that individuals were really productive. But when you started expecting a team to work together, it was then that there wasn't a framework or a mechanism to ensure that a group of people could all deliver an outcome really well together. So he developed this constitution called Holacracy. And at the heart of it is making sure that everybody is clear about the outcomes that need to be delivered and the metrics that clearly define whether you've achieved that outcome or not. And that's, in my opinion, where leadership should be investing its time, is setting the vision, what the outcome is, and giving people these guardrails of what they need to be doing. And what underpinning all of that then are what roles do we need to deliver those outcomes? And what are those individual roles responsible and accountable for? So there's no confusion, there's no dilemma around what's expected of you. So people can take on a number of roles, and they do in our organization. And what the software tool that we're using called GlassFrog does is it gives visibility of who is working on what roles across the organization, what their accountabilities are, so you can spot where people are overwhelmed and being pulled in too many directions, and those that maybe aren't stepping up to perform and take on their fair share of accountabilities across the organization. So it gives you this complete visibility about who's doing what where. And it also brings with it a really effective way to meet. So instead of coming to a meeting and sharing endless information and everybody falls, you know, everybody provides a highlight report and everybody switched off, they're all in their emails. What the meeting structure assumes is that, you know, unless you've got a problem delivering your role, we're not expecting to hear from you. You can give us an update on what you're doing. Mm. You can update that on the projects sheet. But if it's all in hand and you're striving forward, just crack on. And all the meetings do is talk about the tensions. So you build the agenda together and you only bring what's blocking you from delivering the role that you've been invited to deliver.
Mm-hmm.
And the language that's used in the meeting drives accountability. So the questions that people ask or the facilitator of the session asks is, what do you need? So again, it's not passing on or transferring that responsibility to anyone else. You raise the tension and the question is to you, what do you need? And you normally talk in terms of roles. So I need help from the communication role. I need to do X, Y, Z. Can we get together? And you don't do the work in the meeting.
Mm.
You then agree, you know, what you need and you set up a session outside of the meeting.
Yeah.
But what's beautiful about the facilitation is they always come back to you. So even if a side conversation sparks off, the facilitator will come back to the person that raised the tension and said, is this conversation that's happening and going down that rabbit hole, is that helping you? And many times they say it's not helping at all.
Yeah.
And then the conversation,
everyone's got into advice monster problem solving
exactly
mode, and
it's not helping me. So that individual conversation, those people have the opportunity to raise their own tension, but the focus stays on the individual and getting them to have the next step that they need to take to unblock the tension that they're currently facing to move their bit of work forward. And it's just the language that you use and that it drives that accountability. I'm sure we've all been in meetings where, you know, decisions aren't made. It's not clear who is even responsible for decision making. And we all,
blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, we end up in meetings that end up going around in circles and achieving nothing. So it brings this really beautiful meeting structure with it as well. That's been, it continues to be a big culture shock for people that are well versed in talking to now start to own, you know, their part in delivering the outcomes of the team.
Yeah. I love the clarity that that experiment provides in the roles and what's expected, but it's not micromanaging how you do that. Like the empowerment, I know that's an overused word, but just I can feel how you'd feel like I've got the responsibility to deliver on that. And if I need help, I will ask for it. Or if if there are tensions, I can bring it up. And transformation of the meetings as well into something that's more useful. And I guess that way of languaging and supporting one another would flow out beyond the meetings. If you have the corridor conversation and someone goes, oh, you know, drama, drama, you would go into what help do you need to get you through? You know, it would be, that would be part of the culture change.
Exactly. And you just close your eyes and imagine what an organization can do if everybody felt completely empowered and entrusted with the autonomy that they've got to all row in the same direction. You'd go incredibly fast. And what's fascinating is I've been banging the drum about the corporate revel shifts, you know, what they saw happening in workplaces from these progressive environments that they visited. And one of them was greater empowerment and autonomy. Well, you can say that, but unless you bring a framework that really distributes that ownership well, and you don't suddenly claw back the responsibility if that person doesn't deliver, you keep coaching and mentoring them to ensure that they deliver what you need or their performance managed out of the organization. It doesn't allow anywhere to hide, which I really like. You know, even though I have this big heart and I'm full of compassion, I also recognize what poor performance can do and how that can really affect team dynamics. Is, you know, it's a real bad egg, and it can shift people's willingness to do the work. Because what's the point? Because we're all carrying Fred over there who's not pulling his weight. So in this kind of structure, there's nowhere to hide. You have clear roles and accountabilities, and you can bring your tensions, but if you're not delivering, then we have a conversation.
And this goes back to some of the leadership skills you talked about compassion and kindness that isn't niceness. It's holding the line, holding people accountable.
And we will give you the coaching, we'll give you the mentoring. But if you're not even meeting us halfway and attempting to do the work, you have a choice. And that choice is not to keep doing what you're doing, it's to step up or to leave.
It's so interesting that often we won't have those conversations or avoid them, and actually the cost is so much greater in the longer term because of the flow-on impacts and that.
Oh,
I'm
it's,
just aware of the time and your time. You've mentioned corporate rebels a couple of times. Can you just elaborate on that a little
Yeah,
bit? Because
so I read the book. I was involved in the transformation, which is almost a merger as UKRI was formed. And I sat around the table, and for the first time, I was up at the top table. And what I recognized was the massive disconnect between what that top leadership team thought of the people in the organization and what was actually happening on the ground floor, because I'd grown up within the organization. And it was quite alarming to hear the conversations that were being had about people that I knew were, you know, giving their life and soul to an organization. And it was really upsetting. And I, in that darkness of this complete, oh my goodness, if this is what leadership is like, I absolutely do not want to get to the top of the organization. You know, this is not for me. I stumbled upon the work of the Corporate Rebels, and it came in some of the darkest moments of my life where I'd kind of lost despair of we'd ever design an organization that would unlock the people and create the environment for them to thrive and do this amazing work for the world. And I discovered this book, and two Dutch engineers, so really similar to the people within our organization who were working on amazing work and were frustrated by the way in which the organization put this bureaucracy around them that meant that they couldn't do their best work. So they'd jacked in their jobs on a whim and traveled the world to meet with what they classed as progressive organizations. And the book explains eight trends that they saw in the sort of general themes of how these organizations were organized differently. So I read the book and it was brilliant. It was, you know, oh my gosh, I think I read it twice through, you know, straight away. But as a change agent, it didn't give me how to do it. So they were brilliant stories and I could understand the shifts, but it didn't give me the how. So the following years were very much about, okay, so what can we bring as change to an organization to sort of unlock these beautiful environments? And I stumbled upon the work of Aaron Dignan and his book, Brave New Work, was almost the manual of how to do that. And I subscribe now to Harvard Business Review Journal, and there's amazing ideas there. And I've become a massive geek about, you know, how to create these beautiful environments. And the latest one that I am on my second read of is Citizens by John Alexander. And what he talks about is how to move. And it's beautiful for us in the academic environment because he talks about unlocking the citizens or the organization as giving people citizenship of how we all collectively make a difference in how we work and how we lead, but to the benefit of the citizens that we serve. So understanding, you know, what the taxpayer values and aligning the work that we do to what the citizen of the UK would really value us to deliver for the tax invested in us. And it's just, he's doing a lot of work with the UN at the moment, and it's just really inspiring. So, yeah, I've become a massive geek, but I'm always after what's the practical things that we can do to bring about these changes? Yeah. What are the experiments we can run to start to shift the organization to this way of working?
Yeah. And you have talked about specific examples that even within these sort of quite rigid hierarchical organizations with historical ways of doing things, it's still possible to run experiments and to make change.
You need the leadership air cover. You know, I started the continuous improvement movement in 2021 and I worked with the Willin at the Coalface. So I put out a call and said, I've got some funding, I'll invest in your training. Just give me a project, give me something that frustrates you and I'll support you in fixing it. And I'll give you the tools that you can do your problems forevermore. But what I recognized is I could only get so far. So if the individual wasn't given the time to conduct the project, if it wasn't valued by the leadership chain, you know, no matter what I did at the ground floor, I couldn't unlock them being taken seriously. So you absolutely need the leadership buy-in. And we're really fortunate in where we work at the moment that we've got the most brilliant Cyrian Chapman that's taken the reins at the top of UKRI, who really wants to see change for the better. And we've got an amazing team in STFC as well, and the stars have suddenly aligned for hopefully what will be a real big change for the better.
Well, I'm hoping that people who are listening at whatever level they are within an organisation or within their group can also think about how they can step up to be a leader and how they might influence the leaders above them.
So true. So leadership, I think that's been something that dawned on me probably about 5 years ago, is even though I wasn't in a leadership position, you have so much autonomy where you are right now. And, you know, the tiniest of change or the change in behavior or the improvement that you bring to just a team, the ripples that can have are massive. And, you know, so many of us work in victim mode of woe is me, it's done to me, the government, the policies, the, you know, my line manager, the this, the that, the other. And if I could encourage anything, it's to just really to step into that leadership at whatever level you're at. Because an organization really, really values people that don't take the victim approach, that actually do something about it and make a change or make a suggestion of a change and put their hand up to have a go at making that happen.
Yeah.
The work by Robin Sharma, you know, Lead Without a Title, is a book that I hand out to everybody, particularly the sort of young apprentices and graduates in our organization, because you can lead without a title at any level.
Well, you've given us loads of pointers to resources and books, some of which I haven't read, so I'm looking forward to seeing them. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you'd want to say in wrapping up at all?
I think that for any change agents out there that are feeling, the whole system pushing against them, and you do have incredibly dark moments where you almost want to throw the towel in and you'll have a bad day, you'll hit resistance, whether that's, visible or passive resistance. And you do really think, what's the point? And I just want to encourage those people to just keep going. And to, the beautiful work that you've done, Geraldine, is in exposing individuals trying to bring about these changes. And I went to Barcelona to join in on the Corporate Rebel Summit a few weeks back. And it just gives you the fuel, to realise that you're not alone, that it is worthy, really worthy work. And even if it's not appreciated now, it's the hope that one day somebody will look back and go, do you know what? It meant something.
Yes. Yeah.
It really helped. And even if you affect one person, as we said at the start, then you'll have left a legacy to be proud of.
Yeah. That's a lovely point to end on. Well, thank you so much, Jane, for the time, for the generous sharing of your experiences, and for inspiring us to step up and look for ways that we can lead wherever we are right now. So thank
Brilliant.
you.
Thank you very much. And thanks for the invitation.
Wasn't that just a wonderful discussion and a pointer to a different way of working? I know that I've already listened back to this episode twice just because there was so much in there. And I did say that Jane would point us to loads of different frameworks and models and books and other resources. So I've collated all of these and you'll find links to them on the episode webpage. And I'll also include links to two other podcasts that are related to this. One is around fostering psychological safety in research environments from October 24, and also the discussion with Elizabeth Churchill, where she talked also about using the Kinefin framework in her work at Google as part of her leadership role there. You can find the summary notes, a transcript, and related links for this podcast on www.changingacademiclife.com. You can also subscribe to Changing Academic Life on iTunes, Spotify, and I'm really hoping that we can widen the conversation about how we can do academia differently. And you can contribute to this by rating the podcast and also giving feedback. And if something connected with you, please consider sharing this podcast with your colleagues. Together, we can make change happen.